Hey everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. Now, the past couple months, we've had a few workforce issues, practice management issues that we've covered, but this month, we are taking it back to core clinical content. Because after all, we can talk practice of emergency medicine and all the issues and challenges that plague us, but the practice of medicine, like the clinical work, is what brought a lot of us to EM. And I'm, you know, reminded of that every match in particular when you meet the medical students entering the field who are so excited about the variety of pathophysiology and patients that they will see in their careers. Now, I remember as a medical student, a senior resident telling me EM is the most fun 10 minutes of every specialty. And that stayed with me because it's true. Like, we get to see everything. And in a lot of ways, we get to do everything. And that's also what's really sweat-inducing about emergency medicine. I don't have to tell you guys, but we never know what comes through the doors. So how I think of clinical practice is there's the common diagnoses that we can discuss best management and practice on all the time, but that we really all know: GI bleeds, chest pain, COPD exacerbations, etc. And then there's the super rare that get us really excited that we like to cover in simulations and critical courses, critical procedure courses, and so on. And that's things like, honestly, a lot of toxicology, lateral kenthotomies, precipitous deliveries. But then there's this in-between where there's pathology that is rare, but not so rare that you never see it. But it's just unusual enough that management is definitely not front of mind. In this category is where I put electrical injuries. Like, personally, I'm at a large trauma center, and I see a couple of these a year, but that's just enough to be a little rusty on it. So this month's ASAP Now had a great feature on electrical burn management, and we decided to bring on one of its authors, Dr. Alex Koo, to discuss. So check it out. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, thanks again for joining us. We have a very special guest who's an author of an article that is in the magazine this month. Now, the article has some of the best pictures I've seen. It has pictures of a case report that I think just get this visceral response from us of ooh. And the case report title is High Voltage Victim. So yes, you're correct. We are going to be talking electrical burns by one of the authors, Dr. Alex Koo, who is Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at MedStar and Georgetown University. So Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy.
So I love this article. Like, besides the pictures that, again, I was like, when I was going through the proof, I was like, wow, those are great pictures. So I urge everyone to check out either the online or the print of it. But I wanted to feature this because electrical burns, I think, are one of those things that are rare, but not so rare that it like never happens, but just rare enough to not be that up on it. At least that's how I feel about it. And I also love that this was probably one of the first case reports where I saw you guys open with a quick review of the physics, but I thought your explanations were really good. So I wanted to jump right in. When I learned about electrical burns, they always tell you about AC versus DC. And like, it never really conceptualized to me, honestly, what it meant. Like, what is that, you know, how does that change my management? But I thought you had a great explanation. So I wanted to open with that of, yeah, what in the world is AC, DC? You did a good job kind of differentiating the voltage amounts as well.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I think, honestly, the caveat, I'm no physics major, and I'm sure someone that with a lot more physics knowledge is going to probably give a much better explanation. But, you know, I'm pretty simple, so I try and keep it clinically relevant. So really how I think about it is, I mean, first, we have to define it. So AC is alternating current, and DC is direct current. And what we're really describing is how those electrons are traveling. Imagine an imperfect analogy of blowing water through a straw. And so that column of water is your electrons moving back and forth. And so in DC current, that water, if you blow into that straw, that electron or water column is just moving forward in one direction. In AC current, it's going back and forth. So that column of water is going back and forth. So you're sucking through the straw and then you're blowing through the straw. So that column of water is moving back and forth with electrons too. Now that's an imperfect analogy, but that's just how I think about it. Now, why is that relevant? Why do we even have AC and DC? Well, I won't go into the details because I'll be honest, I don't understand all the physics behind of it. But generally speaking, AC is just considered to be a little bit more efficient than DC and bring that good electrical juice across long distances. That's why we have AC. However, DC does have some other advantages. So sometimes it's easier to control. Sometimes it can be more compact because you don't need a motor to kind of alternate that current. So that's why we have these differences still. I hope that kind of explains just a tad bit. And I'm sure some physics professor is going to beat me over the head over this, but it's okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I think any use of, you know, college physics and calling that back into EM practice is a win for physics, you know. But so tell me AC versus DC. Now, you were telling me that AC is actually more dangerous than clinically. So AC is most of what you see in the household, right? Like no one comes to the ER, I feel like, with chief complaint like AC electrical burn. So what are the common household things we should cue that either are AC or are DC, whatever's easier to remember?
Yeah, that's a great question, Amy. So, and great thing to point out in terms of like household things, almost everything in our household outlets is going to be AC. So in the US, all our electrical outlets are typically 120 volts AC, with the exception of like your washer dryer outlet, or if you have an EV or electric vehicle, those outlets that you plug your EV into is going to be 240 volts AC. Now, other things that are in the household, like your laptop charger, your Nintendo Switch, your cell phone, kitchen appliance, those are typically going to be DC electricity. And so those, that kind of helps you differentiate. So any outlets, what I think about is low voltage AC, and most of your batteries and things in the home is going to be low voltage DC. Now, when we get outside the house, I think that's when we talk about those high voltage things. So some of you guys might have like large power lines that kind of go through. That's very high voltage. That's usually also going to be AC. And then if you live in New York City, that third rail that we always say not to touch, that's going to be DC high voltage.
Got it. And so you talked about high versus low voltage as well. And I think your classification of that's really good. Like, where do you have the cutoff of voltage? Like, we know that the house is mostly 120 volts, but, you know, where are there anomalies to this?
Yeah, there definitely can be. And I think it's a little arbitrary. Some texts cite that high voltage is that cutoff of 1,000 volts. And then other texts will say maybe 600 volts. I personally like the 600 volt because clinically speaking, at about 500 volts, the skin resistance that can put up to any sort of or voltage essentially is overwhelmed at about 500 volts, meaning that you can have deeper and more serious injury. So I like the 600 volt as the lower threshold definition of what we consider high voltage.
Got it.
So that's kind of where we go from.
Got it. And I like that because now there's two differentiators. There's AC versus DC with AC being worse, and there's high voltage versus low voltage with obviously high voltage being worse. And then we can kind of blend those to figure out how concerned are we when a patient presents. Is that a fairly accurate summary?
Yeah, you got it right on the head.
Awesome.
No, I forgot to mention, I know you asked about it, but how is that different, like AC versus DC, like clinically in terms of the dangers from it too? Do you mind if we go over that?
Please do.
Yeah, so AC, like you said, is more typically dangerous than DC. And why is that? It's because AC typically has that alternating current, and so it can induce tetany in our muscles, meaning that we actually can have muscle contractions, and this increases our contact time with that electrical source. DC usually is just one direction. It'll just hit you once, but AC can hit you multiple times essentially with that alternating current. When we think about like lightning injuries, like that's very high voltage. We're talking about almost like a billion volts. But you've all heard stories of people that have survived lightning injuries. Maybe you've taken care of a patient with lightning injuries that has survived too. With that billion voltage, people have survived, and it's because how little of that contact time. But AC tends to have longer contact times, which translates into more dangerous burns, more dangerous cardiac dysrhythmias than DC current.
Yeah, and I liked your analogy of the water with it going back and forth, because to me, like, AC is like you're being stabbed over and over and over, right? And then DC is you're stabbed once because it just like zaps you like lightning. So I like this case report. This one, you guys talk about a patient that presented from a high voltage electrical line. So obviously super concerning. And what I liked about it is that you go into the resuscitation and kind of a great approach and then broke out actually, you know, even the injury types that you see with this. So just kind of talk to us about the approach to this patient, whether they're stable, unstable, the injury patterns you first evaluate, like trauma, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think it's just like you said, I think that first differentiation is always what we think about first as ER doctors. It's stable versus unstable. And I think I do approach these differently too. So for that unstable patient, I think two things should come to mind. So number one is just trauma. It has nothing to do with the electrical injury, but more so to the trauma that might be associated with it. Conservatively speaking, like 10% of these high voltage injuries will have some sort of concomitant trauma. For example, this gentleman, he was up on a high voltage line and he was shocked. He fell 10, 15 feet essentially. And so what I'm really concerned about is those traumatic injuries from that fall. And that can be the immediate life threat. Also, other things that can happen with these high voltage injuries is there can be blast injuries, there can be arcing injuries that throw a patient several feet and they can get injuries from that. Or with a blast injury, they can get amputations, or sometimes they can have such significant muscle contractures that it causes some sort of spinal damage, or some what we read about and are tested on our boards is that posterior shoulder dislocation. Even low voltage, that can lead to trauma. So imagine someone is changing a light bulb up on a high ladder. If they get shocked, that shock might not do a ton of damage, but that fall can definitely lead to a lot of injuries, head injuries, all sorts of things too. The number two thing that I think about for an unstable patient is a cardiac dysrhythmia. Now, this is more rare than the trauma that we're talking about, but is specific to these electrical injuries. Sometimes these low voltage and high voltage shocks can cause some sort of cardiac dysrhythmia. And so I do recommend for these patients, they should all be on cardiac monitors when you're able to and have stabilized the patient. Definitely get EKG to make sure that there's no cardiogenic component that's contributing to the patient's unstable medical status. As for the stable patient, I still think about trauma because there can still be fractures, there can still be concussions that people get from falls and all sorts of things that are associated with these stable patients. But number two, I also think about burns. And then three is what we call electroporation injuries.
Now, I love that because I think it's very beaten into us how to run trauma. So your approach here is actually really simple. It's core trauma plus tele-EKG, which I'm like, I can remember that. But let's move on into burns, because this is something a little bit unique. Not only are they burns, but they're like internal burns. So I liked that concept. Like, I didn't really think about it that way, but tell me more about that.
Yeah, we deal with burns every day. We see someone that might have spilled hot ramen on their chest, or someone that had some sort of injury with just like being out in the sun, sunburn or something like that too. So we know how to deal with burns, but I think electrical burns are a little bit nuanced. It's more than what meets the eye. So there can be internal burns as our bodies conduct electricity. Our skin is usually the best initial barrier for defense from this electricity going through. But let's say your skin is overwhelmed because of how high the voltage is, or maybe you have very soft skin or your skin is wet, it'll allow electricity to go through your body. And what conducts the electricity? Now it's deeper tissues, your muscle and your fat, and things that have high resistance will generate heat and cause internal burns. So for example, bones have very high resistance. And so they can heat up as electricity goes through, causing very, very deep tissue burns that we might not see with just our naked eye, essentially. Cardiac muscle can be burned, lung tissue, bowel can be burned, although this is a little bit more rare for bowel injuries. Also, on top of that, vessels can be burned, and this can be manifested with third spacing edema and thrombosis. So I think what's nuanced in terms of the burn resuscitation for these electrical burns is that just because there's an external burn doesn't necessarily mean that's the only burn that you should be treating. You should also have a high suspicion for possible internal burns that you might be dealing with. Now, we talk about total body surface area burned and burn resuscitation, whether you use like Brooks formula, modified Brooks, rule of 10s, all sorts of fluid resuscitation, but that only takes into account your external fluid requirements. And so sometimes you have to think about the increased volume of fluids that might be needed to resuscitate these patients.
Yeah, and I mean, when you mention things like, you know, bones have high resistance, you get deep tissue burns, like that's rhabdo basically, right? Like muscle breakdown, you're going to get like high CKs, et cetera.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it might just be a tiny little burn mark that might be a partial, maybe a deep partial thickness burn on the skin. But inside, if it's conducting that electricity, yeah, you can have tons of swelling burns on the inside, and that's going to destroy a lot of muscle and lead to rhabdo.
Got it. So far it's trauma resus, EKG, and obviously tele to look for anything life-threatening. Move on to the burns with fluid resuscitation and also evaluating for internal injuries, so probably a troponin, a CK. How about when you're getting into this like term electroporation injuries, which I hadn't really, you know, I've actually not heard that word before.
So there are specifics to electrical injuries, and these electroporation injuries are specific to it. So it's basically what happens when there's a flow of electricity can disrupt electrically sensitive tissues. So things like the cardiac conduction system, central and peripheral nervous system, are basically prone to these electroporation injuries. As electricity goes through these electrically sensitive tissues, they can cause inappropriate depolarization. And this can manifest either acutely or delayed. So for example, in the cardiac conduction system, if there's electrical shock that goes through them, that it can cause dysrhythmias like V-fib, AFib, or asystole. And this could happen usually acutely, but sometimes delayed, even hours after initial injury. Other places is like your central nervous system, which can cause delayed sequelae of like cognitive dysfunction, and then also your peripheral nervous system that from that electricity might manifest as clinical symptoms of like paresthesias or anything like that too. So that's why I say electroporation is a little bit different for electrical injuries, that you need to basically think about these electrically sensitive tissues that could get injured. So ECGs for people with electrical injuries is a prudent thing to do, especially when they have symptoms of like chest pain, trouble breathing, or they had a history of passing out or syncope.
Cool. And what do you do dispo-wise? So I'm at actually a level one trauma center mostly, but there's only one or two burn centers in our whole area, and we are not one of them. So what do you think in terms of helping to determine when you need a transfer, or how long do you keep someone for OBS? Like, I mean, if they still have paresthesias but the rest of their workup's negative, like, can you let them go? If their first EKG is negative and their troponin is negative, can you let them go, or do you do repeats? Kind of what's your thought on that? And I say thought because I know that this question is probably sensitive to exactly each facility's unique capabilities and every city's, you know, kind of burn center structure. But I wanted to get kind of a framework from you.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's like very insightful that like we work in all different centers. I work at a level one burn center, and I also work in the community, and I have also worked in austere environments, essentially. So it really depends on, of course, your resources and also the culture of that institution. I'd say just some general guidelines is that all high voltage injuries greater than 600 volts, like we talked about, probably should get a consultation with a burn center. Because of like those deep burns, your skin is overwhelmed. There can be a lot of internal burns that need advanced management. If there's a burn associated and you consult the burn center, there's a high likelihood you'll need to transfer. If it's low voltage and there's no cardiac symptoms and your clinical exam is pretty reassuring, you can pretty much discharge them with routine follow-up in a week or two. If they have some paresthesias, which I've seen before too, is still okay to discharge them. But just to give them good kind of education about that, this might take some time to heal up, and you do need that follow-up to ensure that you're healing up just fine too. Like I said, there can also be some unseen deeper damage that we can't initially kind of evaluate for. So good strict return precautions, as in the sense of vessel damage or anything like that, that can cause the delayed thrombosis, should prompt them to come back to the ER or seek help immediately at that point. There are some in-betweens though. So like we said, we talked about those electroporation injuries, we talked about cardiac symptoms and syncope. What do we do with these patients? So let's see, say their ECG has some changes. Let's say they have a little troponin leak. I think it's reasonable to definitely get cardiology involved, but if you're not a PCI center, most of these patients don't actually have an intervenable like catheterization that is needed for these patients. So they technically, I believe, can be observed at a non-PCI center without any cardiac intervention at that point. However, this is specific to your institution and in consultation with your cardiology team. If there's negative troponins, negative EKG, no cardiac symptoms, technically speaking, a cardiac monitoring could be considered for several hours because there has been delayed dysrhythmias in 12 hours. But honestly, I think practically speaking and practicing out in the community, I don't think it would be always easy to get that observation period of 12 hours in this case. So I would actually probably discharge these patients after some brief cardiac monitoring, maybe an hour, 2 hours with an ECG, and just make sure that they're with a friend and know when to come back if they, for some reason, have any development symptoms or if they pass out again or anything like that.
Yeah, it's always these in-betweens that get us, right? We're really good at resuscitation and we're really good at dispoing when someone probably doesn't really need to be in the emergency department, but it's those in-betweens that make us think. I mean, is it a fair analogy to say like the troponin leak that we can see in these kind of in-between low voltage cases? Is it almost like what you see with like a cardiac contusion, which a lot of times are just obs overnight? Sometimes they're obs in the ED with like a repeat and a goodbye. Like, is that kind of a fair way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to think about it. Like a type 2 MI where there's some sort of maybe demand ischemia, or maybe there's actually some muscle injury from the burn, but it's not necessarily that there's a blood clot that needs to be stented or ballooned open or anything like that too. So really it's just medical management at that point. And of course, making sure that there's no long-term sequela like heart failure or any other arrhythmias that might happen with these troponin leaks and cardiac damage.
Yeah, it's almost like you want to see that the troponin leak is getting better. You want to be there if any major dysrhythmia happens, hence, you know, 12, maybe 24-hour obs, if not just in ED obs. And then, yeah, you definitely don't want to go cath these patients because it's not an obstructive event. So it's kind of an interesting way of thinking about this type of injury pattern for cardiac in these burn patients. Like I said, find this just really nice how you condensed the thought process behind electrical burn patients, like from splitting between AC-DC to high versus low voltage to basically this approach of trauma plus ECG monitoring plus basically internal burn issues like, you know, cardiac leak or maybe a CK, and then obsing / trending lab values in low risk / gray patients. For sick patients, obviously transferring, and then for asymptomatic patients, you know, work up and dispo with follow-up. Like, I think this is like a really tight flow sheet. So I wanted to say thank you for, you know, writing the article, sharing it, and then, of course, for taking the time to chat with us about it.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure being here, and thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Dr. Alex Koo for joining us and helping out on a great discussion and review of an injury that's both interesting and fairly rare. It's a great refresher, certainly for me. Now, what didn't make the cut on the discussion was Dr. Koo was actually kind enough to take a little bit of time away from his paternity leave and had a newborn just a couple weeks old at the time of our interview. So double thanks not only to Dr. Koo, but the whole Koo family for letting us borrow him. Now, as I mentioned, the article is in the magazine and online, and with a great graphic as case report, a high voltage victim. So if you want another refresher, check out that article. It's a good one. Now that's it for us this month. As always, the podcast is just a small snippet of content that we have available at ASAP Now. So be sure to check out the full magazine. We have more on boarding with ASAP Solutions on boarding and also workplace violence. A great feature on our very own Ryan Stanton, who also has the Frontline podcast and is on the ASAP Board of Directors and is also a NASCAR doc. We also have some good clinical pearls on solicit poisoning, tracheoanomnet fistulas, which should be three words that make every ER doctor just pause and shudder. And there's some great pearls on core ortho injuries with fuchsias or fallen outstretched hands. Now tweet us if you have an idea at ASAP Now, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Hope. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks everyone for joining us, and we will see you all next month.